Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, July 3rd, 1999. In the fireside room this afternoon is Jack Nelson Pallmeyer. In today's session, it is titled, Alternatives to War. What if we took Jesus seriously? Let's listen and hear what Jack has to say.
Nelson Pallmeyer. I teach peace studies and theology at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. This is the fifth in a five-part series on the Great Divide, the gap between the rich and the poor, and its relationship to U.S. foreign policy. Now, I know we had a huge influx and a lot of people leaving. I know we've had a lot of turnover, so I'm not expecting that you were here for any or all of those previous sessions. So I welcome all of you. Glad you're here. Just to summarize very briefly some of the ground we have covered, we talked about how in our world today, 60% of the world's people are living and dying on 6% of the world's resources, just to give you an idea of how big that divide is between rich and poor. I did a brief history of U.S. foreign policy following World War II and suggested that the number one preoccupation of the U.S. after World War II was to rebuild Europe and Japan, but that we made a decision that elsewhere throughout the third world or two-thirds world, that U.S. business interests needed to be protected, and that the cheapest way and the most efficient way to maintain stable investment climates in the midst of highly unjust and unequal societies was to put our full weight behind the militaries throughout Latin America. So we had a pretty lengthy period of backing military dictatorships, of building up the military, of setting up secret organizations like the Central Intelligence Agency, setting up things in Chile like DINA, which turned out to be a death squad, similar apparatus in other places. I gave a fairly detailed look of the U.S. Army School of the Americas, which was a U.S. military training school set up in Panama in 1946, forced out of Panama as a result of the Panama Canal Treaty, and relocated where it is today in Fort Benning, Georgia. And to make a long story short, every major human rights atrocity in our hemisphere in the past 40 years has been carried out by graduates of this school. And if you want more information about that, you can look at this book. I understand they didn't really get them ordered in the bookstore. If you want one, all you have to do is make a check payable to me for $12 and give me your address, and I'll send them out a week or so from now when I get back home. Now, in light of all that, you might think that the final session, session five, one other thing. I also stressed that how in recent years it is economic leverage and power that the United States relies upon principally to get other countries to do what we want them to do. And debt, for example, has been a formidable point of leverage where we've been able to use the indebtedness of countries like Mexico and Brazil and a whole lot of other countries through the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank, to essentially get them to restructure their economies, which make them subservient partners in a global economy, and that has a devastating impact on the poor. And unfortunately, a lot of us, or I know some of the people in this room, we became very active in the 1980s because we were very upset when priests and nuns and a lot of religious were killed in Central America by U.S.-backed forces. And one of the sessions I did this week was how the United States specifically and our allies specifically targeted progressive religious and those that were associated with something called liberation theology with a vicious attack throughout Latin America in the 1980s. Okay, you might expect then that the final thrust of this would be to talk about, well, what would a humane U.S. foreign policy look like? And maybe we can get a question or something about that. And certainly, we could have easily named some of the parameters for that. I think we would be working for massive debt forgiveness. We would be dramatically decreasing the U.S. military budget and addressing environmental issues and political issues. We would make our policies much more transparent. We still, I believe, are in a situation where our own democracy can be undermined because of secrecy that we still live with. There's a whole bunch of things that we could talk about. But I've chosen instead to pose in this final session the question, Jesus, who taught us to love enemies, was he crazy? Or are we crazy to ignore his counsel and his example? So that's the framework. And what I'm going to try to do in this last session, after a little while, I'm going to involve you, first of all. And then I'm going to present for a while and give you some background that, at least for me, is very, very helpful in looking at where Jesus came upon his nonviolence. Why did Jesus choose to be nonviolent? And why might that be important for us? And what images of God seemed to drive Jesus in that direction? And how did that conflict or conform to expectations within the Hebrew Scriptures? And by the way, within much of the New Testament that was written following Jesus' death, and we're going to need to assess, and I'll try to do that as best I can. In many ways, I think the New Testament betrays Jesus. And that's a thought you might want to try to get your head around. How can the New Testament that tells us about Jesus betray Jesus? But we're going to take a look at the question of Jesus and nonviolence and his images of God. Okay, well, here's the way I'd like to start. And we won't do this physically just because the room doesn't lend itself very well. But I would like you to, in your minds, I want you to move to some point on a continuum that I'm going to present here. And for those of you who are sitting on the western side, one point, the western wall, we'll see where you would stand. Here's one option. Violence is simply the way of the world. Look around you. There is so much violence. To believe that unrepentant evil can be stopped without violence, you'd have to be an idiot. Okay, that's over there on the western wall, on a continuum. On the eastern wall over here, on the continuum, we would say something like this. Well, violence may or may not be the way of the world, but nonviolence is our only hope. What is crazy is to believe in the utility of violence despite centuries of barbarism and futility. Okay, I'm going to repeat those one more time, and then I'm going to ask a few of you to indicate to me where would you stand if you had to stand somewhere on that continuum, either at a point on the continuum or somewhere in between, and why. And we'll need to do that briefly. But one more time, over here in the west wall, violence is the way of the world. To believe that unrepentant evil can be stopped without violence, you'd have to be a fool. And then on the other side over here on the eastern wall, violence may or may not be the way of the world, but nonviolence is our only hope. What is crazy is to believe in the utility of violence despite centuries of barbarism and futility. I'll ask that the tape be stopped now for a few minutes while we do. Well, what we did is we posed some continuums to try to get us to figure out where we would stand in relation to issues of violence, whether violence is just a necessary part of the world that we need to accept, and so we resist violence violently, or we resist evil violently. And another continuum that asked us to put ourselves out there in terms of how we understand Jesus. Now, let me just very honestly and confessionally say to you that both impulses on that first continuum reside within me, really deeply. I look around at our world and I see it just unraveling because of violence. I see so much evil. And there's a big part of me that says, that's just the way of the world. There's just no way. And then there's another very big part of me that says, century after century after century, when is the spiral going to be broken? And when are people going to stand up to it? So that's confessional. And it also leads me to say that for me, when I make a decision for myself, it can't simply be tactical because I am a person of faith. And because I am a person of the Christian faith, and because I'm trying to make sense out of Jesus. Now, you can find, here's one of the problems, and I'll just state it right out there. I believe, as we read the New Testament, for example, there is not one portrait of Jesus. There are many portraits of Jesus. Now, that's widely acknowledged. Matthew has a version, Mark has a version, Luke has a version, and those are the four different portraits, blah, blah, blah. But I'm saying something a little different. I'm saying we encounter within the Gospels portraits of Jesus that are absolutely and completely incompatible with each other. In other words, I could sit here tonight before you and I could make a very strong case that Jesus would have not ruled out violence, would have welcomed it on occasion, and I could make a very strong biblical case for that. I can make an equally strong case, and I think for myself an even stronger one, that Jesus breaks the spiral of violence in his own person, and that the nonviolent option reveals his understanding of God to be nonviolent. So I'm just acknowledging right out there, and this is a very radical thing I just said. Probably you're aware of that, some of you may not be. Not very many people are willing to talk about Scripture in that way. Not very many people are willing to look at it and say, wow, Jesus says some stuff here, and he says some stuff here according to the gospel writers, Matthew and Mark or Luke, put words in Jesus' mouth that are absolutely incompatible with each other. And somehow we have to wrestle with that and make decisions about which Jesus we listen to and which one we don't and why. Okay, with that background in mind, let me do a number of things. First, three observations. First observation is that for me, our images of God really matter as we address this question of Christian participation or non-participation in the military, or Christian or non-participation in violence, or seeking to resolve conflicts violently or non-violently. So our images of God really matter, and that's one of the things I'm going to try to get at tonight, is to look at what was expected of God, and what does Jesus say about God? What was expected of humans in history, and what did Jesus expect humans in history to do? Again, obviously through my vantage point that I'll be trying to share with you. Second, I intentionally use the term, many of you were not here for Wes's Bible study, Wes Howard Brooks Bible study, but he posed the question fairly often about unrepentant evil. And so I use that phrase specifically in the way I portray things. But what I'd like to point out to you is that unrepentant evil wears many faces. So, for example, a lot of us would think unrepentant evil. Well, that's Milosevic we're talking about. But given if you were here for my presentation on the U.S. Army School of the Americas and the fact that the U.S. has been training torturers in Fort Benning, Georgia, has a long record of backing death squads in Central America, unrepentant evil wears a different face. There's a lot of people who would say, what do you do when you've got someone like George Bush? What do you do when you've got someone like Bill Clinton who uses the UN and violates international law? From their perspective, unrepentant evil wears a very different face than most of us do. And I would suggest that feeds, that's the third point I wanted to make. I gave some background earlier in the week on the understanding of a spiral of violence. That violence feeds on itself. And the classic definition of a spiral of violence is that you have oppression from someone's perspective, and poverty and hunger, and sometimes people rebel. That's the second violence, and then the third violence is the violence of the state or the paramilitary groups that just crush it. And that spiral of violence feeds itself over and over and over and over again. And I think we need to look at this question of Jesus' teaching about love of enemies in the context of images of God and in the context of that he was living in the midst of unrepentant evil. For those of us who attended the Bible studies of Wes Howard Brooks certainly got a good taste of what empire was like in, during, and after the time of Jesus. So this was, Jesus did not live in a time unlike our own. Tremendous injustice, tremendous violence of the Roman Empire, tremendous violence all around. And yet, he teaches what we'll come to. He talks about love of enemies. Okay. Let me. It's going to be an interesting attempt to, in about 12 or 15 minutes, summarize the Bible. Okay. In terms of issues of violence, so you'll have to bear with me as I whip along. As classically understood, what is the Exodus story about? Okay. Israelites are oppressed by who? Pharaoh. The Egyptians. And what does God do? Okay, God sends a bunch of plagues. God uses violence and liberates the people, right? It's a story of liberating violence of an oppressed people. At least that's how it's understood. Well, here's the first thing I'd like to have you take a look at is open up to Exodus, the first chapter, second book in the Bible. You probably knew that. So Exodus, and just read with me. It says the total number of people born to Jacob was 70. Joseph was already in Egypt. I'm starting with verse 5.
What
chapter 1. Exodus chapter 1. And then we get, then Joseph died, and all his brothers and that whole generation. But the Israelites were fruitful and prolific. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them. And then here's the key verse, verse 8. Now a new Pharaoh, or a new king, arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. Now, when I first read this first chapter of Exodus, after having used the Exodus as a story of liberation for decades myself, in my own writing, when I read this, I thought of a couple of things here. One, these first couple of verses didn't fit my image, because my image was that these were vulnerable, weak, very small minority of people being crushed by the Pharaoh. This says that they were very strong, very prolific, very fruitful, exceedingly strong, and the land was filled with them. That's a little different image. And then what really caught my attention was verse 8 when it said, now the timing is now a new king or a new Pharaoh rose in Egypt. And I thought, that didn't know Joseph. So I thought, well, what was Joseph's relationship with the old Pharaoh? So I want you to just turn back a couple pages to Genesis 47. And so just a couple pages back, Genesis 47, we read about Joseph's father, Jacob, starting in verse 10. Read along with me. It says, then Jacob blessed the Pharaoh. Wow. And went out from the presence of Pharaoh. Joseph settled with his father and his brothers and granted them a holding in the land of Egypt, in the best part of the land, in the land of the Ramesses, and the Pharaoh had, as the Pharaoh had instructed. And Joseph provided his father's brothers and all his father's household with food according to the number of their dependents. Now, here we go. Now, think of what Joseph's role is here. Now there was no food at all in the land, for the famine was very severe. The land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. Joseph collected all the money to be found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan in exchange for the grain that they bought. And Joseph brought the money into the Pharaoh's house. Strike one. Every person in Egypt now has absolutely no money because Joseph is working food as a weapon during a famine on behalf of the Pharaoh. When the money from the land of Egypt and from the land of Canaan was spent, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, give us food. Why should we die before your eyes, for our money is gone? And Joseph answered, give me all your livestock, and I will give you food in exchange for your livestock if your money is gone. So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them food in exchange for the horses, the flocks, the herds, and the donkeys. That year he supplied them with food in exchange for all their livestock. Strike two. Now they have no money, and they have no livestock. When that year ended, they came to him in the following year and said to him, we cannot hide from my lord that our money is all spent and the herds and cattle are my lord's. We give it all we have to you. There's nothing left in the sight of my lord but our bodies and our lands. Shall we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land in exchange for food. We with our land will become slaves to Pharaoh. Just give us seed so that we may live and not die and that the land may not become desolate. Well, at the end of this passage, Joseph working a food famine, a food weapon on behalf of the Pharaoh. Everyone in Egypt now has no food, has no land, is enslaved, no money. They're enslaved. They lost everything. Well, I'm not going to belabor this point, but my first point is that in my own writing that I'm doing right now, I'm trying to reinterpret this story of the Exodus, not as a story of liberation, but as a story about how the spiral of violence works. Because what happens? A new Pharaoh that didn't know Joseph comes to power. And what does he do? Does he try to equalize everything and make sure, well, we had some problems because the Israelites got too strong? No. The response is, you crush your enemy. And that's what's happening. A reversal, a spiral of violence, only now those who were put down are now the ones who are in a position of power who can put the Israelites down. And the spiral repeats itself. So just to think about that. That the Exodus may not be a story about liberation. It may reveal to us more about a spiral of violence than it does liberation. Okay, so that's the first. Second thing to know is that if you read in the Exodus account, the overwhelming, what makes God God? There's a lot of competition between gods. And what makes God God, God is God because of superior what?
Power.
If you were to fill in the blanks.
Power.
Another word for power that we've been talking about? Violence. What proves that you're God is when your people crush other people. That's how you prove that you're God. Turn to Exodus 15. Actually, there's a lot better passages, but I don't have my notes with me, and I don't have the book I'm reading with me, and so I just kind of scrambled around for a few verses just to illustrate the point. But this is a song sung to the Lord after the Egyptians are crushed. It says, I will sing to the... 15 begins, first verse. I will sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. Horse and rider he has thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and my might. He has become my salvation. Next point to note. Overwhelming definition of salvation. Throughout Exodus, throughout the prophets, throughout the Psalms. Here's a challenge for you. After we leave today, just start glancing through the Psalms and see how many times the word saved or salvation comes up. And in almost every instance, salvation means the expected crushing defeat of your enemy. Okay, I'll illustrate that in just a minute. But just to read on here, the Lord is my strength, my might, he has become my salvation. This is my God, and I will praise him. My father's God, and I will exalt him. The Lord is a warrior, the Lord is his name. Pharaoh's chariots and his army he has cast into the sea. His picked officers were sunk in the Red Seas. The floods covered them. They went down to the depths like a stone. Your right hand, O Lord, glorious in power, your right hand, O Lord, shattered the enemy. In the greatest of your majesty, you overthrew your adversaries. You sent out your fury. It consumed them like stubble, etc., etc. And then it goes on down to verse 11, says, who is like you, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like you? Majestic in holiness, awesome in splendor, doing wonders. You stretched out your right hand. The earth swallowed them. What proves that God is God is superior violence. Now, I want to introduce you to very quickly to a couple of key storylines. And we're going to try to pay close attention in these storylines to the issue of violence as a way of trying to frame where Jesus is in continuity or discontinuity with his tradition over images of God and violence. And the first one, the one I've mentioned, is Exodus. Now, let me just be really clear that I said I think there are problems in interpreting the Exodus story as a story of liberation. The Canaanites, for example. What about the Canaanites? God shows up as a land thief, right? And the Canaanites are there, and they get wiped out. God literally orders the people, in some of the passages, to commit genocide against the Canaanites who are living there. But, putting that aside for a few minutes, within the Exodus, the way Exodus was understood within the tradition, within much of the biblical story, it was a story about liberation. And it was that God chose this people, delivered them into a land that God gave them. Okay? So God's liberating violence on their behalf. Okay? Crushing the Pharaoh, giving them the Canaanites' land, the chosen land. Chosen people, chosen land. So far, it sounds really good to be aligned with this God, this superior, this God whose violence is superior. Except, all of a sudden, what happens? I mean, historically, if you read the Hebrew scriptures, what happens over and over and over again is that God's people get crushed. The Assyrians come along, and the Babylonians come along, and empire after empire crush the people of God and send them into exile. Well, what's the traditional explanation for that? Turn to to Leviticus 26. Okay, starting with verse 3, again, I'm going to read just because I'll read fast and we need to read fast, but you'll get the gist. Basic explanation that comes throughout the Hebrew Scriptures, a major storyline, says if we're obedient, if we obey God, if we follow the covenant, if we do things right, if we worship in the right place at the right time, do the right rituals, do the right sacrifices, and sometimes if we're just enough and we do this right, then we're blessed. But if we don't, watch out, because you become the enemy of God and God's violence is turned on you and you're in deep, deep, deep trouble. Okay, that's a summary of what we're going to read here. And I'll just read a few verses very quickly. So beginning with 26 verse 3, it says, if you follow my statutes and keep my commandments and observe them faithfully, I will give you your rains in their season, and the land shall yield its produce, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit. You'll have great harvests. Goes down further in verse 7. You shall give chase to your enemies, and they shall fall before you by the sword. You'll crush your enemies. All you got to do is be obedient, and God will be with you. Now, shift over down blah, 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 to verse 14. But if you will not obey me, and do not observe all these commandments, if you spurn my statutes, etc., I in turn will do this to you. I will bring terror on you, consumption and fever that waste the eyes and cause life to pine away. You shall sow your seed in vain, for your enemies shall eat it. I will set my face against you, and you shall be struck down by your enemies, etc., etc., etc. Pretty clear. Now, there's an image here of a very powerful God that's in charge of everything, so everything that happens has to be explained in relation to God's will, God's power, and the message is very simple. Obey, do things properly, you're going to be blessed. Disobey, and you're in deep trouble, including you're going to lose this land. Okay, people lose the land. They try to explain it. The explanation that comes back from the priests is, this is all a consequence of disobedience, of sin, of not being just enough, of not being holy enough, of not sacrificing the right places, of following other gods. There's a whole series of things. But the message is pretty clear. Now, this message was always suspect. There were always those who said, boy, that just doesn't make sense. And I would suggest to you that one of the books in the Bible that says that doesn't make sense, the world just isn't ordered that neatly, is the book of Job. And the book of Job, unfortunately, I think, ends with a few editorial additions that tries to downplay this tension. But Job was really written to say, it's not that simple. It doesn't work that way. But still, this worldview goes along and along and along. And the promise and the expectation is, yeah, you're in exile now, but God will save you. And what did that mean to say God will save you?
Take you home.
Take you home by doing what?
Crushing.
By crushing your enemies. And let me just give you an illustration of that. First of all, just sing for me. How many of you know the song? By the rivers of Babylon. Anybody sing that? As we sat down and there we wept when we remembered Zion. Okay, well, you don't know that song. I thought you did. This, I have sung that song for years. It's from Psalm 137. And it's about the people entering exile and they're asked to sing God's song in Babylon. Now, this actually reveals two things, and this is a total aside, but something to think about again. One of the reasons that the Israelites couldn't conceive of how they could sing this song is because they understood their God to be a geographical deity. God was among many gods, but God was the God of Jerusalem. God was the God of Israel. You don't worship the God. How do you worship the God of Israel when you're in Babylon? It's a territorial deity, which should make us rethink a lot of things that we don't have time to talk about. What I wanted to point out was that nice song, and then you read verse 8. O daughter Babylon, you devastator, happy shall they be who pay you back what you have done to us. Happy shall they be who take your little ones and dash them against the rock. Now, I'm not going to take the time to do it, but I will just make a point, and I think I could demonstrate it if we had the time, that in psalm after psalm after psalm and in prophetic utterance after prophetic utterance, the promise to the people of God is that salvation will come. God will save you. And when God saves you, your enemies will be crushed. The kings will be brought. All their wealth will come to you. They will lick the dust off your feet. This is the promise to the people of God from the scriptures. Well, so we got Exodus, we got exile, and then in the 2nd century BCE, a new empire comes on the scene, the Seleucid Empire. And the book of Daniel is written in this context. And the people are getting plastered. They're getting killed left and right. The emperor, the Antiochus, the leader of the Seleucid Empire, says you have to turn the Jerusalem temple into a worship center for Zeus. You can't practice your traditions, and anybody who does is going to get killed. And he does it. I mean, anybody trying to follow their Jewish religious practices are getting murdered. And Daniel starts out, if you read the book of Daniel, Daniel starts out by saying, answering the question, why is this happening to us? It's happening to us because we sinned. We were bad. We deserved it. The empires are God's hand in punishing us for our wrongdoing. And in the writing I've been doing, I say somewhere along the way, the people who heard that must have looked at Daniel and said, go take a hike. Get out of here. Because the most faithful of the faithful people are being killed. It's the people who are standing up to Antiochus. You can't possibly say these people deserve to die because they're worshiping other gods, because they're doing things wrong. And so Daniel introduces a whole nother explanation. And how many of you attended Wes's Bible study? A few of you did. This is a very different view of apocalyptic than the book of Revelation, in which he stressed over and over that the meaning of apocalyptic in that context was to lift the veil, to see what was going on behind. That's, to a certain degree, that's true here too. But what Daniel sees is very different than what John of Patmos saw. And so what Daniel does when he enters the apocalyptic worldview, he explains to the people why they're suffering. He says to them, well, you're getting crushed by this empire and you're getting killed, not because God wants this to happen to you, not because it was a consequence of your sin, but because God's preoccupied. God is fighting a war in heaven between the forces of good and the forces of evil. There's a huge, violent war that God is involved with in heaven. And that, until that war is resolved, you're going to get crushed. But here's the good news. The good news is the victory is coming really soon. God is going to prevail in heaven, and then that opens up new possibilities on earth. Second good news is God is going to come in a wave of violence and is going to wipe out all the evildoers. So all those enemies of yours that are now killing you will be killed by God. And the third thing, and this is for the first time really in the Jewish tradition, gets introduced the idea of resurrection. Daniel introduces the idea, those of you who have faithfully resisted this empire, you will be raised, even if you're killed, you will be raised from the dead. Everybody will be raised from the dead, and the evil ones will go to permanent punishment, and the good ones will be vindicated and blessed by God. So that's the apocalyptic world. Well, lo and behold, during Daniel's time, there's a guerrilla movement, a Jewish guerrilla movement, that fights against Antiochus, overthrows him, and they win. Wow, that was amazing. And so for a while in the tradition, this, by the way, Daniel dealing with about 165 BC. So the Maccabees take power, and this would have been the dream. This was the promised dream. The prophet said, one day you're going to be independent. One day you're going to crush your enemies, and then it's going to be wonderful. Guess what? It was horrible. It was horrible. The same oppression, the same inequalities, the same brutal violence, only now it's happening at the hands of the Jewish Maccabees against their own people. And so for a little while after the Maccabees won, People said, wow, this proves that that whole holy warrior image of God is right. Look, we were a small force. God's holy violence joined with us, and we defeated empire. But then the Maccabees rule very, very brutally, and it doesn't go very well. And that gave rise to a whole other understanding of expected violence. And right around the time, right before Jesus is born, the expectation is, these Maccabees, they didn't work out very well. What's really going to come is a new Davidic Messiah, a new Messiah like David, a new political military ruler sent by God is going to come and crush the Romans and throw them out. Israel is going to be the triumph of the nations. All the wealth is going to come our way. It's going to be great. And guess what? Around 4 BCE, which is about when Jesus was born, Herod the Great dies. Herod, everybody know who he was? Herod was a client king on behalf of Rome. He was a half-Jew. He ruled brutally for 20, 30 years on behalf of Rome. And he dies, and the people hated him. He literally taxed them to death. He built worship centers for the emperor. He also rebuilt the temple, and he got some of the priests to collaborate with him, but he was bad news. Brief summary, bad news. Herod dies, and there's rebellions all throughout Palestine. And you know what? Initially, they succeed. And they're fighting, and they take over the Roman arsenal and Sepphoris, and they're doing pretty well. And they succeed enough that they actually appoint their own messiahs. They appoint these military leaders. They call them messiahs. They appoint them popular kings. And everything looks great. Except for what happens. The Roman legions come in and just crush them. And guess what that gave rise to? This worldview again. Apocalypticism. Bad news is always good for apocalypticism. When things are going bad historically, you just say, the only thing that can happen is it's got to be an act of God. Into the story comes John the Baptist. John the Baptist comes in and he says, the winnowing fork is right here. God's apocalyptic violence is about to come. A new violent coming of God. We're going to throw the rascals out. All the evil people are going to be destroyed. And we, the good, are going to be vindicated. And guess what? What do we know about Jesus? Where do we first encounter Jesus? Being baptized. Well, it depends on which gospel. But in all four gospels, being baptized by John. What that indicates to me is that Jesus was a follower of John the Baptist. Even though the tradition tells the story differently, Jesus was probably a follower of John the Baptist. That means Jesus probably started out embracing this apocalyptic expectation of God's violence. But what we also know, if you read the story carefully, is Jesus breaks with John. And the question is, why? And I would like to suggest that the question that we can answer that over expectations of God in history, particularly violence. Would someone be willing to look up Isaiah 61? And then the rest of you, give me a volunteer to look up Isaiah 61. You've got it? Okay. Rest of you, look at Luke 4. What are we doing here? Oh boy, we gotta hurry. Okay. I'm gonna read Luke 4, starting with verse 18. Jesus is in the temple, opens up the scroll and reads from it according to Luke, and he says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." A jubilee. All right, now. You who opened Isaiah 61, read verses 1 through 2 and listen carefully. There's a verse left out of the Lucan version.
"The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me because the Lord has anointed me. He has sent me to bring good news to the oppressed, to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and release to the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn."
Interesting verse left out about the vengeance of God. Okay, turn to Matthew 5. Okay, I'm going to do this one really quickly. Turn to verse 43. And I'm going to read this a more literal translation than we have. It says, you have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Nowhere, by the way, does it ever say that specifically in the Hebrew Scriptures, that you should hate your enemy, although the defeat of enemies is oftentimes expected. But the Essenes, which was a group that withdrew from society and said you couldn't be God's people living in society, so they withdrew. They literally taught the hatred of enemies. So this is probably a response to them. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be children of your Father in heaven. For God makes the sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the righteous and on the unrighteous. Wow, that's a pretty powerful thing. Going up a few verses before that, verse 38, says, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, do not use violence to resist an evildoer. That's the more literal translation. It's not do not resist. Jesus resisted all the time. Do not use violence to resist an evildoer. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. People who were struck on the right cheek were being humiliated by a superior. This is not a fist fight. So backhanded slap, put you in your place. And Jesus is saying, when the powerful try to put you in your place, resist them and stand up and say, oh yeah, go ahead and hit me here too. All right? Second example. If anyone wants to sue you and take your, again, more literal, take your outer garment, take off your underwear as well. Okay? So they're being brought before the court. Their poor are constantly being ripped off. Usually they had to sell their land, then they sold their families into slavery. It was a really bad, bad deal. Now this person has nothing but their outer garment left, and they got taken in. And Jesus says, well, if they do that, take off your clothes. Stand naked before the court. Because in the Hebrew Scriptures, those who look upon nakedness are the ones who are shamed. Shame the court and point out the unbelievable injustice. You've taken everything, you might as well take my underwear too. And then third, if a Roman soldier forces you to go 1 mile, go the second mile. Roman soldiers had the right to force any Israeli sitting around to just grab their pack and carry it. It used to be they could force them to do it forever. But people were so upset, they limited it to 1 mile. So now after 1 mile, Jesus says, oh, start, keep walking. And the Roman soldiers, stop! Stop, you're going to get me in trouble. These are non-violent, tactical stuff in the midst of oppression that Jesus is teaching us. And then that verse that I read about why says, why? Because that's the way God is. Be compassionate as God is compassionate, because God makes the sun rise on evil and good. Pretty interesting images of God. One more passage, Mark 3, 1 through 6. Now, to make a long story short, I can throw my any class I ever teach in religion, and almost any group of Christians I'm ever with, I usually throw them into a complete tizzy by asking them a simple question. Who killed Jesus and why? And my students, they no one has ever asked them about it. They've never really thought much about why Jesus got killed. They just know that he died for our sins, because that's what we've been taught. Well, then I have them read Mark 3, 1 through 6. Jesus entered the synagogue, and a man was there who had a withered hand. They watched him to see whether he would cure him on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse him. And he said to the man who had the withered hand, come forward. Then he said to them, listen to this question carefully, I'll come back to it. Is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath, to save life or to kill? But they were silent. He looked around at them and with anger. He was grieved at their hardness of heart and said to the man, stretch out your hand. He stretched it out and his hand was restored. The Pharisees went out and immediately conspired with the Herodians against him how to destroy him. So here we have a plot to murder Jesus between Herodians, representatives of the client king, rulers of Rome, and the Pharisees, a branch of the religious officials, which I think, long story short, we should probably just read here, temple leaders and Roman client kings are plotting to murder Jesus. A couple of things interesting about this passage, and then I'll open it up. first thing is, Jesus fundamentally transforms the definition of salvation. Salvation is not defeat of enemies. Salvation is healing and restoration to community. This is one example we have in this passage. Second, and this would take much longer to explain, but I'll just mention it here to think about, is hardness of heart is mentioned here. Right? Jesus grieves at their hardness of heart. He's angry and grieves at their hardness of heart. Where do we hear about hardness of heart? The Exodus story. Only in the Exodus story, who hardens Pharaoh's heart? God does. And if you read the story, God hardens Pharaoh's heart in order to have an opportunity to prove that God is God through superior violence. Go back and read the text. That's exactly what they say. God says, I harden Pharaoh's heart in order that I can show my mighty power and show that I am God, not these other gods. Well, Jesus says, hardness of heart of these Pharisees and the Herodians is it's a systemic necessity. When you're part of a violent, unjust system, your heart can't be soft. Jesus doesn't blame the hardness of heart on God. Jesus poses it directly back on systemic evil, which, if you were with me earlier in the week and we talked about structural violence and injustice, that makes a lot of sense. And then one final observation about this passage. Very interesting question. It says, Jesus says, is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath, to save life or to kill? Here's Jesus healing someone on the Sabbath, and it spawns a murder plot against him. Well, here's what I think was going on. There were all kinds of rules, Sabbath regulations. And the Sabbath regulations included, you couldn't do any work on the Sabbath. You couldn't fight on the Sabbath. You couldn't engage in military activity on the Sabbath. And so throughout history, when the Israelites were fighting their battles, it turned out on occasion that Sabbath day rolls around and their enemies didn't stop fighting. So there were all kinds of exceptions. Well, okay, exception, you can fight on the Sabbath if you're engaged in a battle that already started. And then then it got wider yet. Well, you can engage in warfare on the Sabbath even if it hadn't started before, as long as it's defensive. And then it got wider yet. Well, basically, yes, you can engage in military activity anytime you want, as long as it's for God's purposes. Well, at least one commentary that I've read on this says, Jesus here, one of the reasons they may plot to murder him is that Jesus here is undermining the argument in favor of even violence for self-defense. Now, I don't know, that may be taking it too far, but what I wanted to do was to suggest that when Jesus teaches us to love enemies, I think he is opening up very new ground in terms of even his own tradition about what God is like. And Jesus says, be nonviolent because God is nonviolent. That's the way God is. The last thing I'll say, Jesus' nonviolence was taken seriously for at least several centuries by the vast majority of Christians. For many, many, or a long period of time, you could not be a Christian and a soldier. Then you couldn't be a Christian and a soldier that engaged in military activity. You could only build roads. And then pretty soon, it became that only Christians could be soldiers in the Roman Empire. So we've moved a very, very long way. Now, the question I would pose to you, Paul Wellstone and I, he's a senator from Minnesota, he and I agree on many, many things. I am a principled Christian nonviolent activist because of my understanding of Jesus. He's a principled politician who is Jewish, who takes very seriously many of the same issues I do, but he would say, I'm just not a pacifist. Now, where we could both agree is that what we need to do is to invest in nonviolent options, and that all we invest in a world and in our country are violent ones. And if we invested in nonviolent options, that might not resolve this question for all. We might not resolve it the same and say every single problem in the world can be met with nonviolently. We might disagree over that, and we would at least have some options. But what I would like to suggest to you, from my vantage point, is that because Christians have treated Jesus' statement of love of enemies as an idiotic statement that doesn't apply to us, that can't have meaning in our lives, there is absolutely no constituency that will work for nonviolent opportunities, other than a handful of Christians who take the nonviolence of Jesus seriously. And I think that is fundamentally our task as we enter a new century. Because if we don't, if Christians don't take up the nonviolent vocation, my own view is we're doomed. Now, I don't expect you all to share that, but that's the background. We have a few minutes that we can take a couple of questions and comments. I apologize for how much time this took. Yes?
Well, Martin Luther King certainly accomplished a lot through a nonviolent program.
When you think of King, you think of Gandhi, you think of the Philippines, fight against Marcos, you think that most of the European countries, and at least in their initial collapse of the Berlin Wall, almost all of that resistance was nonviolent. So, and there are people like Gene Sharp and others who have very detailed strategies of national self-defense for this country based on nonviolent resistance. I think there are many, 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 many options, but we explore very few of them because of the mindset that we're in. Yes?
What do you do with the teaching about judgment? Do you find it's strong in the New Testament as well as on the lips of Jesus?
Yes. Again, this is where the controversy expands. And this is also where I think a lot of the work of trying to look at what comes from the gospel writers and what is traceable to Jesus is really important. Let me just give you one example. And this is it's a controversial example with this scholarship, so I don't mean to suggest. But I'll just say two things. One is there's a common document that Matthew and Luke share that isn't from Mark. They also share Mark. And they just simply call it Q. No one has ever seen Q, but it's common material to both of them. There are scholars. All they do is study Q. And these scholars have now come up with three different layers of Q. An early layer of Q, a middle level of Q that was added 10, 15 years after Jesus, and then a later layer yet. Very interesting that they say that in the early layer of Q, there is absolutely no apocalyptic judgment stuff from Jesus. That all the original sayings of Jesus, there are very sharp things about share what you have, but it comes like this. It's like, share with the poor because that's what God is like. God is a compassionate God. In layer two, it would say, share with the poor, and if you don't, God is going to get you. So there's all I can say in a short answer is that it really depends upon how we read Scripture, and that's where I started. Because there are many things attributed to Jesus that I don't think are traceable to Jesus. And the problem is, in scholarship, is how do you prove what's what? And there are methodologies. And I would say one of the most careful scholars that I know is a guy named John Dominic Crossan. If you want a really excellent, there are some books in the bookstore by him. But his latest book is called The Birth of Christianity. And what's been fascinating for me, I followed Crossan's work for quite a while. And he's been writing for 30 years. Is that in this recent book, The Birth of Christianity, the most thoughtful scholar in our century, as far as I'm concerned, has come out with absolutely strong statements saying that he now believes that Jesus absolutely embraced the nonviolence of God. So that's all I can say. It's not an easy one to resolve, but we need to, it's where I started. There are statements that, if you read some of Matthew has some of the most vile, violent stuff placed on the lips of Jesus is unimaginable to me in light of other statements about Jesus and in light of my own experience of Jesus. So I think we have to really wrestle with it. Yeah.
One of my experiences in the military was they used to give us this, this classified briefing, and they would tell you about how the Soviet Union and their officers were more dedicated and their soldiers were better trained and be afraid, be really afraid, you know. And it was clearly propaganda. I mean, you sit there going, yeah, yeah, yeah. But these, and still, I come out of those going, oh. And this guy said, oh, don't worry about it. They run their whole country the way we run the military. They're gonna kill themselves. And it was true. And that's a reading of how do you deal with violence and violent evil in the world is contain them. They'll kill themselves. You don't have to do it for them.
Well, I think we need to close here. Let me just, and I'll be glad to stick around for a few minutes and talk with people. But for me, the most challenging thing of all of this is to try to pay attention to what images of God guide us. And what I'm suggesting, and I don't know if anybody else is suggesting this, and I'm sure it's going to get me in a lot of trouble, is what I'm suggesting is that in a sense we allow Jesus to be our guide and try to look at what his images of God are and to see that there are many places where he is in continuity with his Jewish tradition. But there are also many places where he breaks with that, and we need to ask ourselves why. Now, one other irony to leave you with, and this is also what I'm writing about. Most Christians don't take Jesus' nonviolence seriously at all. That's my judgment. Most churches rarely, we certainly don't think about it as normative behavior or important revelation of what God is like, with a few exceptions. Here's the irony. Most nonviolent Christian activists who take the nonviolence of Jesus seriously root their own nonviolence and the nonviolence of Jesus in the violence of God. For example, they say, Richard Horsley says, Jesus was nonviolent because he understood that God was violent and God would take care of his enemies. Daniel Berrigan, you know, you're probably familiar with the Berrigans, John Howard Yoder, Thomas Merton, whole series of nonviolent activists root their nonviolence in the promise of God's redemptive violence, that God will ultimately punish the evildoers, therefore we're okay. Now, what I'm suggesting in my own work is that Jesus broke with that, and that we can't root our nonviolence in violent images of God, that we have to root our nonviolence in the nonviolence of God, as demonstrated by Jesus. So I'll leave you with that thought. Thank you.
Thank you.